20. The toga party was not terrible at all. It was, in fact, wonderful. It was this. Finding the Vancouver crowd all lounged on sheet-covered furniture in a sitting room, all dressed in sheets themselves, everything black and white, black hair, white teeth, black shadows, white skin, black floor, white cotton. They were people Gansey knew, Henry, Ching Tu, Riang, Lee Squared, Ko, Rutherford, Six Steve. But here, they were different. At school, they were driven, quiet, invisible, model students. Aglenby Academy's 11% of our student body is diverse. Click the link to find out more about our overseas exchange programs. Here, they slouched. They would not slouch at school. Here, they were angry. They could not afford to be angry at school. Here, they were loud. They did not trust themselves to be loud at school. It was this. Henry giving Gansey and Blue a tour of Litchfield House as the other boys followed in their togas. One of the things about Aglenby that had always appealed to Gansey was the sense of sameness, of continuity, of tradition, of immutability. Time didn't exist there, or if it did, it was irrelevant. It had been populated by students forever and would always be populated by students. They formed a part of something bigger. But at Litchfield House, it was the opposite. It was impossible not to see that each of these boys had come from a place that was not Aglenby and would be headed to a life that was also not Aglenby. The house was messy with books and magazines that were not for school. Laptops were tipped open to both games and news sites. Suits hung like bodies in doorways, worn often enough to require easy access. Motorcycle helmets rolled up against used boarding passes and crates of agriculture magazines. Litchfield House boys already had lives. They had pasts, and they hurtled on beyond them. Gansey felt strange. He felt he had looked into a funhouse mirror. The details wrong, the colors the same. It was this. Blue, teetering on the edge of a fence, saying, "I don't understand why you keep saying such awful things about Koreans, about yourself." And Henry saying, "I will do it before anyone else can. It is the only way to not be angry all of the time." And suddenly, Blue was friends with the Vancouver boys. It seemed impossible that they accepted her just like that, and that she shed her prickly skin just as fast. But there it was. Gansey saw the moment that it happened. On paper, she was nothing like them. In practice, she was everything like them. The Vancouver crowd wasn't like the rest of the world, and that was how they wanted it. Hungry eyes, hungry smiles, hungry futures. It was this. Ko demonstrating how to make a toga of a bedsheet and sending Blue and Gansey into a cluttered bedroom to change. It was Gansey politely turning his back as she undressed and then Blue turning hers, maybe turning hers. It was Blue's shoulder and her collarbone and her legs and her throat and her laugh. Her laugh. Her laugh. He couldn't stop looking at her. And here, it didn't matter because no one here cared that they were together. Here, he could play his fingers over her fingers as they stood close. She could lean her cheek on his bare shoulder. He could hook his ankle playfully in hers. She could catch herself with an arm around his waist. Here, he was unbelievably greedy for that laugh. It was this. K-pop and opera and hip-hop and 80s power ballads blaring out of a speaker beside Henry's computer. It was Ching Tu getting impossibly high and talking about his plan to improve economics in the southern states. It was Henry getting drunk, but not loud, and allowing Riang to trick him into a game of pool played on the floor with lacrosse sticks and golf balls. It was Six Steve putting movies on the projector with the sound turned down to allow for improved voiceovers. It was this. The future beginning to hang thick in the air, and Henry starting a quiet, drunk conversation about whether or not Blue would like to travel to Venezuela with him. Blue replying softly that she would, she very much would, and Gansey hearing the longing in her voice like he was being undone, like his own feelings were being unbearably mirrored. "I can't come," Gansey asked. "Yes, you can meet us there in a fancy plane," Henry said. "Don't be fooled by his nice hair," Blue interjected. "Gansey would hike." And warmth filled the empty caverns in Gansey's heart. He felt known. It was this. Gansey starting down the stairs to the kitchen, Blue starting up, meeting in the middle. It was Gansey stepping aside to let her pass, but changing his mind. He caught her arm, and then the rest of her. She was warm, alive, vibrant beneath the thin cotton. He was warm, alive, vibrant beneath his. Blue slid her hand over his bare shoulder and then onto his chest, her palm spread out flat on his breastbone, her fingers pressed curiously into his skin. "I thought you would be hairier," she whispered. "Sorry to disappoint. The legs have a bit more going on." "Mine too." It was this, laughing senselessly into each other's skin, playing until it was abruptly no longer play, and Gansey stopped himself with his mouth perilously close to hers, and Blue stopped herself with her belly pressed close to his. It was this, Gansey saying, "I like you an awful lot, Blue Sergeant." It was this, Blue's smile, crooked, wry, ridiculous, flustered. There was a lot of happiness tucked in the corner of that smile, and even though her face was several inches from Gansey, some of it still spilled out and got on him. She put her finger on his cheek where he knew his own smile was dimpling it, and then they took each other's hands, and they climbed back up together. It was this moment, and no other moment, and for the first time that Gansey could remember, he knew what it would feel like to be present in his own life. 21. Ronan could tell straight away that something wasn't right. When they stepped into Caveswater, Adam said "day" at the same time that Ronan said "fiat lux." The forest was ordinarily quite attuned to the wishes of its human occupants, particularly when those human occupants were either its magician or its Grey Worn. But in this case, the darkness around the trees remained stubbornly present. "I said fiat lux," Ronan snapped, then grudgingly, "amabo te." Slowly, the dark began to rise, like water bleeding through a paper. It never made it quite to full daylight, however, and what they could see was not right. They stood among black trees blossomed with dull gray lichen. The air was gloomy and green. Though there were no leaves left on the trees, the sky felt low, a mossy ceiling. The trees had still said nothing. It was like the dull hush before a storm. "Huh," said Adam out loud, clearly unsettled. He was not wrong. "You still up for this?" Ronan asked. Everything was reminding him precisely of his nightmares. The entire evening did. The race to the trailer, Robert Parrish's specter, the sick gloom. Chainsaw would have normally taken flight to explore by now, but instead she ducked on Ronan's shoulder, claws dug tight into his jacket. And like one of Ronan's dreams, he felt he knew what was going to happen before it did. Adam hesitated, then he nodded. It was always impossible to tell in the dreams if Ronan knew what was going to happen before it did or if the things only happened because he thought of them first. Did it matter? It did when you were awake. They took a moment at the edge of the forest to establish their location. For Ronan, it was merely moving around enough for the trees to see that he was among them. They would do their best to do what he wanted, which included not letting anything supernatural murder him. For Adam, it meant linking into the ley line that pulsed beneath the forest, unwrapping himself and allowing the bigger pattern inside. It was a process that was both eerie and awesome to watch from the outside. Adam, then Adam vacated, then Adam more. Ronan thought about the story of Adam's wandering eye and rogue hand. I will be your hands. I will be your eyes. He sliced the thought out of his head. The memory of Adam bargaining part of himself away was too frequent a visitor in his nightmares already. He didn't need to call it back up again through intention. Are you done with your magician business? Ronan asked. Adam nodded. Time? Ronan handed him his phone, glad to be rid of it. Adam studied it. 6:21, he said with a frown. Ronan frowned too. It was not puzzling because it was unexpected here. Time on the ley line was always uncertain, skipping to and fro, minutes taking hours, and vice versa. What was surprising was that 6:21 had now happened enough outside of the ley line to arouse their suspicions. Something was happening, but he did not know what. Are you done with your Grey Warren business? Adam asked. That's ongoing, Ronan replied. Cupping his hands over his mouth, he shouted into the hush, Orphan girl! Far off through the still green air, a raven called back, Ha! 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 Chainsaw hissed. Good enough for me, Ronan said and set off through the green trees. He wasn't happy about the gloom, but it wasn't like he was a stranger to working in nightmares. The key was to learn what rules and fears they were playing off as quickly as possible and lean into them. Panic was how you got hurt in nightmares. Reminding the dream that you were something alien was a good way to get ejected or destroyed. Ronan was good at being a dream thing, especially in Caveswater. They kept going. All the while, the forest continued being wrong around them. It was as if they walked on a slant, though the ground beneath them was level enough. Tell me again, Adam said, carefully catching up, how your dreams were wrong. Use less cursing and more specifics. Without changing Caveswater around us? Even though Caveswater had been slow to respond to their request for light, it didn't mean that it would be slow to respond to a nightmare prompt. Not when it already looked like this, a gray-green half-world of black trunks. Obviously, they were wrong like this. Like what? Ronan said, just like this. He didn't say anything more. He shouted, Orphan girl!
Caw! Caw! Call.
This time it sounded a little more like a girl, a little less like a bird. Ronan picked up the pace a little. Now they were climbing. To their right, a bare rock surface slanted steeply down with only a few small trees bursting from cracks in the naked surface. They picked their way cautiously along this precarious edge. A loose step would send them sliding for yards with no fast way to climb back up. He glanced behind to make sure Adam was following. He was, looking at Ronan with narrowed eyes. Do you think your dream is wrong because Caveswater is wrong? Adam asked. Probably. So if we fix Caveswater, we would fix your dreams? Probably. Adam was still processing, thinking so hard that Ronan imagined he could feel it. Actually, in Caveswater, with Adam so close to him, it was possible he really did. You could dream things into being before we found Caveswater, right? Can you do it without Caveswater? Ronan stopped and squinted through the gloom. About 15 yards below, the slanted rock slide they'd been walking along ended in a pool of perfectly clear water. It was tinted green because the air was green, because everything was green. But otherwise, the water was clear. Ronan could see all the way to its rocky bottom. It was clearly far deeper than it was wide. A chasm filled with water. It held his attention. Why? If you cut yourself off from Caveswater somehow until I fixed it, would your dreams be normal? Here it was. Adam was finally asking the right questions. The questions that meant he probably already knew the answer. The longer they spent in Caveswater, the more they worked together with Ronan's dreams, the more Caveswater's nightmares were reflected in Ronan's and vice versa, the more the evidence piled up. But now that they were to it, Ronan wasn't sure he wanted to be on the other side. So many days on a pew with his knuckles pressed to his forehead, silently asking, "What am I? Am I the only one? What does this mean?" He said, "I can do it better with Cave's Water. With Orphan Girl, too, but..." He stopped. He looked at the ground. "Ask me," he said. "Just do it. Just ask you what?" Ronan didn't reply. Just looked at the ground. The green air moved all around him, tinting his pale skin, and the trees curved black and real around him. Everything in this place looking like his dreams, or everything in his dreams looking like this place. Adam pressed his lips together, and then he asked, "Did you dream Cave's Water?" Ronan's blue eyes flicked up to Adam. 22. It was 6:21. "When?" Adam asked. "When did you know that you dreamt Cave's Water? Right away?" They faced each other at the top of the slanted rock face, that clear pool far down below. Adam's heart was racing with either adrenaline or with sheer proximity to the ley line. "Always," said Ronan. It should not have changed the way he saw Ronan. The dreaming had always been impressive, unusual, a god glitch, a trick of the ley line that allowed a young man to make his thoughts into concrete objects. Magic, but a reasonable magic. But this, to not only dream an entire forest into being, but to create a dream space outside of one's own head. Adam stood in Ronan's dreams. That was what this realization meant. Ronan corrected himself. "Sort of always. Just the moment we got here, I recognized it. My handwriting on that rock. I guess I knew right away. It just took me longer to believe it." Every one of Adam's memories of those early forays into the forest were slowly shifting inside him, pieces falling into place. "That's why it calls you the Grey Warren. That's why you're different to it." Ronan shrugged, but it was a shrug from caring too much instead of too little. "That's why its Latin grammar is terrible. It's your grammar." Ronan shrugged again. Questions cascaded through Adam, too difficult to say aloud. Was Ronan even human? Half a dreamer, half a dream, maker of ravens and hoofed girls and entire lands? No wonder his Aglenby uniform had choked him. No wonder his father had sworn him to secrecy. No wonder he could not make himself focus on classes. Adam had realized this before, but now he realized it again, more fully, larger, the ridiculousness of Ronan Lynch in a classroom for aspiring politicians. Adam felt a little hysterical. That's why it speaks Latin at all and not Portuguese or Welsh. Oh, God, did I... He had made a bargain with this forest. When he fell asleep and Cave's Water was in his thoughts, tangled through his dreams, was that Ronan? "No," Ronan said fast, his tone unschooled. "No, I didn't invent it. I asked the trees after I figured it out. Why the hell, how the hell this happened? Cave's Water existed somehow before me. I just dreamt it. I mean, I made it look this way. I chose these trees and this language and all that shit for it without knowing. Wherever it was on the ley line before, it got destroyed and then it didn't have a body, a shape. When I dreamt it, I brought it back into physical form, that's all. What did they call it? Manifested it. I just manifested it from whatever other fucking plane it was on. It's not me." Adam's thoughts spun in the mud. He made no progress. "Cave's Water isn't me," Ronan repeated. "You're still just you." It was one thing to say it, and another thing to see Ronan Lynch standing among the trees he had dreamt into being, looking of a piece with them because he was of a piece with them. Magician. No wonder Ronan was all right with Adam being uncanny. No wonder he needed him to be. I don't know why the fuck I told you, Ronan said. I should have lied. Just give me a second with it, will you? Adam asked. Whatever. You can't be pissed off because I'm thinking this through. I said whatever. How long did it take you to believe it? Adam demanded. I'm still trying, Ronan replied. Then you can't, Adam broke off. He suddenly felt as if he had been dropped from a height. It was the same sensation as when he had known Ronan was dreaming something big. He just had time to wonder if it had truly been the ley line or merely the shock of Ronan's revelation when it happened again. This time, the light around them sagged in time with it. Ronan's expression had sharpened. The ley line, Adam began and then broke off, uncertain of how to finish this thought. Something is happening to the ley line. It feels like when you're dreaming something big. Ronan spread his arms out, meaning clear. It's not me. What do you want to do? I don't know if we should stay here while it's like this, Adam said. I definitely don't think we should try to make it to the Rose Glen. Let's call her just a few more times. Ronan eyed Adam, assessing his status, correctly seeing that Adam was feeling like he needed to kneel in his apartment with his hands over his head and think about what he had just learned. He said, "How about just once more?" Together they shouted, "Orphan girl!" Intention sliced through their shared words, sharper than the gloom. The forest listened. The orphan girl appeared, her skull cap pulled low over her enormous eyes, sweater even mankier than before. She could not help but be off-putting in this gray-green wood, not arriving like she did, skittering between dark trees. She looked like she belonged in the vintage photographs Adam had seen in the barns, a lost immigrant child from a destroyed country. "There you are, you urchin," Ronan said as Chainsaw chattered nervously. "Finally." The girl offered Adam's watch back to him reluctantly. The band had acquired some tooth marks since he'd last seen it. The face of it said 621. It was very grubby. "You can keep it," Adam said. "For now." He couldn't really spare the watch, but she didn't have anything, even a name. She started to say something in the strange, complicated language that Adam knew was the old and basic language of whatever this place was, the language that young Ronan must have mistaken for Latin in his long-ago dreams, and then stopped herself. She said instead, "Watch out." "For what?" Ronan asked. Orphan girl screamed. The light dimmed. Adam felt it in his chest, this plummeting energy. It was as if every artery to his heart had been scissored. The trees howled. The ground shivered. Adam dropped to a crouch, pressing his hands into the ground for breath, for help, for cave's water to give him back his heartbeat. Orphan girl was gone. No, not gone. She was plummeting yards down the slanted rock face, fingers clawing for purchase, hooves scraping dully, tiny rocks tumbling down with her. She didn't cry for help. She just tried to save herself. They watched her slide straight into that pool of clear water, and because it was so transparent, they could see how far she plummeted into it. Without pause, Ronan leapt after her. 23. It was 6:21. Ronan hit the water hard enough that he saw sparks behind his vision. The pool was as warm as blood, and the moment he thought about that heat, he realized that he remembered this pool. He had dreamt it before. It was acid. The heat was because it was eating him. At the end of his dream, there was nothing left of him but bones, white picked sticks in a uniform like Noah. Immediately, Ronan threw all of his intention out toward Cabe's water. Not acid, he thought. Make it not acid. Still, his skin warmed. Not acid, he said out loud to the pool as his eyes stung. Liquid flowed into his mouth, sucked into his nostrils. He could feel it bubbling under his fingernails. Somewhere below him was Orphan Girl, and she'd been in the strange sea for a few seconds longer than he had. How long did he have? He couldn't recall the dream well enough right now to know. He breathed words directly into the acid. Make it safe. Cabe's water heaved around him, shuddering, shrugging, trying to grant his appeal. Now he could see Orphan Girl sinking slowly just below him. She'd covered her eyes. She didn't know that he'd come after her. Probably didn't expect any help. Orphan Girl, Orphan Boy. Ronan struggled toward her. He was an okay swimmer, but not without air, not through acid. The liquid growled against his skin. He snatched her oversized sweater and her eyes opened wide and strange and startled. Her mouth formed, Kira? And then she seized his arm. For a moment, they both sank. But she was not stupid, and she began to paddle with her free hand and kick off the stone walls. It felt like they had sunk miles beneath the surface. Cave's water, Ronan said, huge bubbles escaping from his mouth. His brain was failing to problem solve. Cave's water, air. Cave's water would keep him safe ordinarily. Cave's water knew how fragile his human body was ordinarily, but it wasn't listening to him now. Or it was, but it couldn't do anything about it. The pool boiled around them. He was going to die, and all he could think was how, if he did, Matthew's life was over too. Suddenly, something hit his feet, pressed against his hands, crushed his chest. His breath, he only had time to seize the Orphan Girl before everything went black. And then he burst out of the water, propelled from below. He was vomited up onto the rocky edge of the pool. Orphan Girl rolled from his arms. Both of them coughed up the liquid. It was pinkish from the blisters on his tongue. Leaves were plastered all over Ronan's arms, all over the Orphan Girl's arms. So many leaves. Looking woozily over his shoulder, Ronan found that the entire pool was filled with vines and shrubs. Tendrils still grew slowly out of the pool. The submerged parts of the plants were already being eaten away by the acid. This was what had saved them from drowning. They had been lifted by the branches. Adam crouched on the other side of the pool, head dropped low like he was about to sprint or pray, his hands pressed to the rock on either side of him, knuckles white. He had placed a few small stones between his hands in a pattern that must have made sense to him. One of the still-growing tendrils had tangled around his ankles and his wrists. The proper truth, struck Ronan. The plants had not saved their lives. Adam Parrish had saved their lives. Parrish, Ronan said. Adam looked up, eyes blank. He was quivering. Orphan Girl scrambled around the pool, keeping well back from the edge to Adam's side. Hurriedly, she knocked the tiny stones into the pool with her finger and thumb. At once, the vine stopped growing. Adam sat back with a shiver, expression still far away and ill. His right hand twitched in a way that was not quite comfortable to look at. Orphan Girl took his left hand and kissed the palm. He merely closed his eyes, and then she turned her urgent gaze to Ronan. She said, "Out! We need him out!" "Out of where?" Ronan asked, picking his way around the pool to them. He looked up at the rock face, at the mountainside around him, trying to plot a path out.
"Cabe's water," Orphan Girl said. "Something is happening. Ah!"
In between the submerged and damaged leaves in the pool, the liquid was turning black. This was a nightmare. "Get up, Parrish," Ronan said, gripping Adam's arm. "We're getting out of here." Adam opened his eyes. One lid was drooping. He said, "Don't forget, she's coming with us." 24. It was 6:21. No one had been answering the Foxway phone for ages. Bluehead obediently used Gansey's phone to call home every 45 minutes as her mother had asked, but no one picked up. This didn't strike her as unusual the first time. If the line was tied up with a long-distance psychic consult, outside calls rang through to voicemail. It was unusual when it kept happening, though. Blue tried again in another 45 minutes, and then another. "We need to go," Blue said to Gansey. He did not question it. Neither, to Henry Ching's credit, did he, even though he was quite philanthropically drunk and would have rather they stayed. Instead, he seemed to instantly divine that this was private and to be left untouched. He accepted their bed sheets and bid them good night and begged Blue once more to travel to Venezuela with him. In the car, they realized that Gansey's watch kept turning 6:21. Something was wrong. At 300 Fox Way, she tried the front door. Although it was late, was it late? It was 6:20, now 6:21. Always 6:20, then 6:21. The door wasn't locked. Beside her, Gansey was both wary and electric. They closed the front door behind them. Something was wrong. In the dark house, Blue could not immediately tell what was amiss, only that she was absolutely certain something was. She was frozen with it, unable to move until she determined what was troubling her. This, she thought, must be what it is like to be psychic. Her hands quivered. What was wrong? It was darker, perhaps, than usual. The ambient light from the kitchen failing to penetrate the night. It was cooler, perhaps, than it ordinarily was, but that might have been her anxiety. It was quieter, with no chattering of television or clink of mugs, but that could have been simply the lateness of the hour. A bulb flickered. No, it was just car lights reflecting off the glass face of the clock on the hallway table. The clock said 6:21. She couldn't move. It seemed impossible to be trapped here by dread and nothing more, and yet she stood. She told herself that she had crawled through mysterious caverns, stood under the sparks of a nightmare dragon, and been in the presence of a desperate man with a gun, and so the mere fact of her very own house with no obvious threat shouldn't paralyze her. But she couldn't move, and Gansey did not stir either. One finger was pressed absently against his left ear. His eyes had the glassy look that she recalled from his panic attack in the cave not long ago. She had half a thought that they were the last two people left in the world. She would step into the living room and find nothing but bodies. Before she could catch herself, a single note of a whimper escaped from her. "Be sensible." Gansey's hand fumbled into hers. His palm was sweaty, but it didn't matter. Hers was, too. They were both terrified. Now that she thought about it, the house was not silent after all. Beneath the quiet, she heard something crackling and humming like discordant electronics. Gansey's eyes darted to hers. She squeezed his fingers tightly, gratefully. Then at the same time, they released each other's hands. They weren't sure if they'd need both hands to defend themselves. "Move, Blue." They started forward, gently, both hesitating if the floorboards began to creak, both afraid to make a sound until they were sure of what they found. Just afraid. At the base of the stairs, she rested her hand on the solid knob of the railing and listened. The hum she'd heard before was louder now, more dissonant and alive. It was a buzzing, wordless song, eerily voicing one note before modulating to another further up the unfamiliar scale. A thud from directly behind them made Gansey start. But Blue was glad for this sound, because she knew it. It was the brush clunk of her cousin's giant clogs on the uneven floor. With relief, she turned to find Orla, comfortingly familiar and silly in her usual bell-bottoms. Her gaze was fixed on some place over Blue's head. "Orla," Blue said, and her cousin's eyes dropped to meet hers. Orla screamed. Blue's hands acted without her mind, cupping over her ears like a child, and her feet followed suit, stumbling back into Gansey. Orla pressed her hands over her heart and screamed again, the sound cracking and pitching higher. It was nothing Blue had ever thought she'd hear out of her cousin. Some part of Blue darted away from it, making it not Orla's face screaming, making it not Blue's body watching, making it a dream instead of reality. Orla fell silent. Her eyes, though, she was still looking past Blue at nothingness, at something inside herself. Her shoulders heaved with horror. And behind everything, that hum continued from somewhere in the house. "Orla," Gansey whispered. "Orla, can you hear me?" Orla didn't reply. She was looking at a world that Blue couldn't see. Blue didn't want to say the truth, but she did anyway. "I think we have to find the sound." Gansey nodded grimly. Leaving Orla in her unseeing weeping, they crept deeper into the house. At the end of the front hall, the light of the kitchen seemed to promise safety and certainty. But between them and the kitchen was the blackness of the reading room doorway. Although Blue's heart told her that the interior of the room was completely dark, her eyes showed her that there were three candles on the table within. They were lit, but it didn't matter. They didn't affect the blackness. The strange multi-headed buzz spilled from inside the reading room. There was also a dull scuffling, like someone running a broom over the floorboards. Gansey's knuckles brushed tentatively against hers. "Take a step." She took a step. "Go in." They went in. On the floor of the reading room, Noah twisted and twitched, his body impossible. Somewhere he was dying, always dying. Even though Blue had seen him reenact his death before, it never got easier to watch. His face turned to the ceiling, his mouth open in mindless pain. Gansey's breath hitched audibly. Above Noah, Calla sat at the large reading table, her eyes focused on nothing at all. Her hands rested on top of scattered tarot cards. A phone sat beside them. She'd been in the middle of a long-distance reading. The dissonant hum was louder than anything. It was coming from Calla. "Are you afraid?" Noah whispered. Both Gansey and Blue started. They hadn't realized that Noah had stopped twitching, but he had, and he was lying on his back, knees drawn up, looking at them. There was suddenly something a little taunting about his expression, a little un-Noah-like. His skull's teeth smiled through his lips. Blue and Gansey glanced at each other. The thing that was Noah suddenly gazed up as if it had heard something approaching. He began to hum, too. It was not musical. Every cell in Blue's body burned a warning at her. Then Noah duplicated and singled. Blue wasn't sure how else to put it. There was a Noah, then another right beside him, facing the other way, and then the single Noah again. She could not decide if it was an error in Noah or an error in how she was seeing Noah. "We should all be afraid," Noah said, his voice thin through the buzzing. "When you play with time." He was suddenly close to them. Eye to eye, standing, or at least just his face was, and in a blink he was a few feet away again. He'd pulled some of his Noah-ness, his boy guise, over himself again. He had his hands on his knees like a runner, and every time he panted out, the hum, reluctantly, escaped him. Blue's and Gansey's breath hung in a cloud before them, shimmering, like they were the dead ones. Noah was pulling energy from them, a lot of energy. "Blue, go," Noah said. His voice was strained, but he'd controlled the hideous humming. "Gansey,
Go. It won't be me.
He slid to the right and then back again. It was not the way matter was meant to behave. A lopsided smile snuck across his mouth, utterly at odds with his knitted eyebrows, and vanished. There was a challenge in his face, and then there wasn't. We're not leaving, Blue said, but she did begin to throw all of her protection up around herself. She could not keep whatever had Noah from drawing on both Ganzi and Calla, but she could cut off her own considerable battery. Please, Noah hissed. Unmake her. Unmake her. Noah, Ganzi said, you're stronger than this. Noah's face went black, from skull to ink in the opposite of a heartbeat. Only the teeth glowed. He gasped or laughed.
You're all going to die.
Get out of him, Blue snarled. Ganzi shuddered badly with the cold. Noah, you can do this. Noah lifted his hands in front of him, the palms and fingers facing each other like a clawsome dance. They were Noah's hands, and then they were scribbly lines. Nothing is impossible, Noah said, his voice flat and deep. The darting sketch lines took the place of his hands again, corrupt and useless. Blue could see inside his chest cavity, and there was nothing there but black. Nothing is impossible. I'm coming for him. I'm coming for him. I'm coming for him. The only thing that kept Blue planted, the only thing that kept her so close to this creature, was the knowledge that she was witnessing a crime. This wasn't Noah being unintentionally terrifying. This was something in Noah, through Noah, without permission. The buzzing voice kept going. I'm coming for him.
Blue!
I'm coming for him.
Please, go!
I'm coming for him.
I won't leave you, Blue said. I'm not afraid.
Noah let out a wild laugh, a goblin's delight. In a high sideways voice he thrilled, you will be!
And then he threw himself at her. Blue caught a glimpse of Ganzi's snatching form just as Noah's claws dug into her face. The reading room went as light as it had been dark, pain and brilliance, cold and heat. He was digging out her eye. She wailed, Noah! Everything was squiggling lines. She threw her hands to her face, but nothing changed. She felt hooked onto claws. His fingers dug in her flesh. Her left eye saw only white. Her right eye saw only black. Her fingers felt slick. Her cheek felt hot. Light was exploding from Noah like a flare off the sun. Suddenly, hands gripped her shoulders, wrenching her away from him. She was surrounded by warmth and mint. Ganzi held her so tightly that she could feel him trembling against her. The hum was everywhere. She could feel it in her burning face as Ganzi twisted to put himself between her and the buzzing fury that was Noah.
Oh, Jesus, Blue, I need your energy, Ganzi told her right into her ear, and she heard fear lace through his words. Now!
Pain exploded with every beat of her heart, but she let him take her slick fingers. Ganzi gripped her hand. She took down all the walls around her energy. Crisp and certain and loud, he told the thing, be Noah. The room went silent. 25. It was 6:21. A little less than 600 miles down the ley line, a million tiny lights winked across the dark, cold ripples of the Charles River. The toothful November air found its way in the balcony door of Colin Greenmantle's Back Bay townhouse. He had not left the door open, but it was open nonetheless, just a crack. In they crawled. Colin Greenmantle himself was on the ground floor of the townhome in the golden brown, windowless room he had reserved for his collection. The cases themselves were beautiful, glass and iron, mesh and gold, suitably outlandish displays for suitably outlandish objects. The floor beneath the cases was made of oak reclaimed from an old farmhouse in Pennsylvania. The Greenmantles always preferred to possess things that used to be someone else's. It was impossible to tell how large the room really was because the only lights were the spotlights that illuminated each unusual artifact. The bulbs glowed through the blackness in each direction like ships in a night sea. Greenmantle stood in front of an old mirror. The edge was all carved in acanthus leaves and swans feasting upon other swans, and a brass-rimmed clock was embedded in the topmost frame. The clock face read 6:21 p.m. Supposedly, the mirror itself beaded tears on viewers' reflections if they'd had a recent death in the family. His reflection was dry-eyed, but he felt like he looked pitiful anyway. In one hand, he held a bottle of Cabernet Sauvignon whose label promised notes of cherry and graphite. In the other hand, he held a pair of earrings he had obtained for his wife, Piper. He was wearing a beautifully cut jacket and a pair of boxers. He was not expecting company. They came, anyway, picking their way across the crown molding of the second floor library, crawling over each other's bodies. Greenmantle took a swig of the wine directly from the bottle. When he'd selected it from the kitchen, he had thought it would look more aesthetically pathetic and desperate than carrying a solitary glass, and it did. He wished there was someone here to see just how aesthetically pathetic and desperate he looked. "Notes of black powder and abandonment," he told his reflection. He took another swallow. This mouthful he choked on. A little too much black powder and abandonment at once. His reflection went wide-eyed. His wife stood behind him, fingers wrapped around his throat. A few of her blonde hair strayed from her otherwise smooth hair, and the collection lights behind her burned these strands golden white, fiery. Her eyes were black. One of her eyebrows was raised, but she looked otherwise unperplexed as her fingertips pressed into his skin. His neck purpled. He blinked. She wasn't there. She had never been there. She had left him behind. Well, in fairness, he had left her behind, but she'd started it. She was the one who had chosen to perpetuate a considerable amount of tactless, violent crime in the wilds of Virginia, right when he had decided he was ready to take his toys and go. "I'm alone," Greenmantle told the mirror. But he wasn't. They buzzed down the stairs, alighting upon the tops of the picture frames and ricocheted into the kitchen. Greenmantle turned from the mirror to face his collection. A four-armed suit of armor, a taxidermy unicorn the size of a pygmy goat, a blade that continuously dripped blood on the floor of its glass case. It represented the finest of nearly two decades of collecting. Not really the finest, Greenmantle mused, merely the objects he thought most likely to capture Piper's attention. He thought he heard something in the hallway to the room. A humming or scratching. Not quite scratching. It was too light for that. After numerous personal betrayals, Colin Greenmantle had a nervous breakdown in his late 30s, Greenmantle narrated, ignoring the sound, leading many to believe he would fade into obscurity. He regarded the earrings in his hand. He had taken steps to acquire them over 2 years before, but it had taken this long for his suppliers to cut them from a woman's head in Gambia. Rumor had it that the wearer could see through walls. Certain types of walls, anyway. Not brick, not stone, but drywall. They could handle drywall. Greenmantle didn't have pierced ears, so he hadn't tried them. And with Piper pursuing a new life of crime, it seemed, he might never find out.
But the onlookers had underestimated Colin's personal fortitude, he said. His ability to bounce back from emotional injury.
He turned to the door just as the visitors exploded through it. He blinked. They did not disappear. He blinked and blinked again, and something was still coming in through the door, something that was neither his imagination nor a cursed mirror image. It took his mind a moment to process the sound and the sight to realize it was not a single visitor, it was many. They poured and tumbled and scrabbled over one another. It was not until one broke free from the horde and flew at him erratically that he realized that it was insects. As the black wasp landed on his wrist, he told himself not to slap it. It stung him. "Bitch," he said, and swung the wine bottle at it. Another wasp joined the first. Greenmantle shook his arm, dislodging it, but a third flew at him. A fourth. A fifth. A hallway full of them. They were all over him. He was wearing a beautiful jacket and boxers and wasps. The earrings fell to the floor as he spun. In the mirror, his reflection dripped tears, and he saw not wasps, but Piper, her arms and smile wrapped around him. "We're through," her mouth said. The lights went out. It was 6:22. 26. You could say what you liked about Piper Greenmantle, but she wasn't a quitter, even when things didn't turn out exactly as she imagined. She kept going to Pilates long after it was physically satisfying, continued attending book club after she discovered she was a far speedier reader than her fellow members, and persisted in getting fake mink eyelashes sewed into her own every 2 weeks, even after the salon location closest to her was shut down for health violations. So when she went looking for a magical sleeping entity supposedly buried near her rental house, she didn't quit until she found it. "Unmaker." That had been the first thing it had said when she'd found it. It had taken her a moment longer to realize that it was replying to her question, "What the hell?" In Piper's defense, the sleeper was unsettling. She'd been expecting a human, and instead she'd found a murder-black, six-legged creature that she would have called a hornet if she didn't firstly find hornets repellent and secondly think hornets had no business being 11 inches long. "That is a demon," Neve had said. Neve was the third leg on their uncomfortable tripod. She was a mild-voiced, squat woman with pretty hands and bad hair. Piper thought she was a television psychic, but could not remember how she'd arrived at this information. Neve had not seemed happy to have uncovered a demon, but Piper had been dying at the time and unchoosy with her friends. She'd skipped over all other social niceties and said to the demon, "I woke you. Do I get a favor? Fix my body."
"I will favor you."
And it had. The air in the darkened tomb had gone a little shifty, and then Piper had stopped bleeding to death. She'd expected that to be the end of it. It turned out, though, that a favor was a one-time affair, but favoring was forever. Now look at her. They were out of that cave. The sun was sort of shining, and Piper had just killed her cowardly dirtbag husband. Magic was churning through her, and to be honest, she was feeling pretty badass. Beside her, a waterfall was crashing upward, backward, the water spraying up into the sky in great gasps. The tree closest to Piper was shedding its bark and peeling wet clumps. "Why does the air feel like this?" Piper asked. "It's like it's scratching me. Is it going to twitch like this the entire time?"
"I believe it is calming," Neve said in her faded voice. "The further we travel from the moment of your husband's death, these are aftershocks. The forest is trying to rid itself of the demon, which seems to use the same power source, focused through the forest. The forest is reacting to being used to kill. I can sense that this place is about creation. And so any step you take that is opposite to that will cause this kind of spiritual quake."
"We all do things we don't want to," Piper said, "and it's not like we're going to be killing loads of people.
This was just to prove to my father that I was being serious about making up with him.
The demon asked, Now what do you wish?
It was clinging to the marled old bark of a tree, back hunched in the way hornets curl when they are in the cold or damp or breeze off a waterfall. Its antennae quivered in her direction, and it still hummed in time with a swarm that was no longer in evidence. Overhead, the sun shook. Piper had a thought that it wasn't really daytime at all. Another bit of bark sloughed off the tree.
Are you harmful to the environment?
Piper had always been attentive to her carbon footprint. It seemed pointless to have spent 2 decades recycling if she was going to destroy an entire ecosystem.
I am a natural product of this environment.
A branch sagged to the ground beside Piper. Its leaves were black and running with a thick yellow liquid. The air continued to shudder.
Piper?
Neve took Piper's hand in a tender way, looking as serene as someone could when dressed in tattered rags beside a waterfall traveling in reverse.
I know that when you plunged into the sleeper's tomb, pushing me out of the way, ensuring that you and you alone would have the sleeper's favor, you were hoping to cut me out of the loop and continue in a future where you and you alone controlled your own choices and enjoyed the demon's favor, probably leaving me in the cavern to wander at best and die at worst. At the time, I'll admit I was very upset with you, and the feelings I had then are not feelings that I'm proud of now. I see now that you not only have some trust issues, and you didn't know me, but if you want...
Piper missed a large part of this as she noticed Neve's shapely fingernails. They were enviably perfect little coins of keratin. Piper's own nails were ragged from clawing out of the collapsed cavern.
There are better ways to accomplish your goals. Really, it's essential that you learn to rely on my considerable experience in magic.
Piper's attention focused.
All right. I zoned out there, but what? Skip all the feelings parts.
I don't think it's wise to pair yourself with a demon. They are inherently subtractive rather than additive. They take more than they give.
Piper turned to the demon. It was hard to tell how attentive it was. Hornets didn't have eyelids, so it was possible it was asleep.
How much of this forest will have to die to get my life back?
Now that I am awake, I will unmake all of it. Either way, eventually.
Well then, Piper said, she had the sense of relief that came from a bad decision being made for.
That's settled. We might as well make hay while the sun shines. Hey, where are you going?
Don't you want to be?
Piper listened, and the demon leaned on her thoughts.
Famous?
Neve blinked.
Respected.
Same diff, Piper said. Well, don't go just yet. I did sort of shaft you before because I was dying and sort of rude. Just a little, but I want to make it right.
Neve looked less enthusiastic about this than Piper had hoped, but she at least didn't try to run away again. This was positive. Piper didn't really want to be alone with the demon. Not because she was scared, but because she felt more energized with an audience. She'd taken an online quiz that said she was some special sort of extrovert and that she was likely to be this way for the rest of her life.
This is going to be a new start for both of us, Piper assured Neve.
The demon tilted its head, its antennae waving again.
Horned eyes were not meant to be so large, Piper thought. They were like big brown-black aviator sunglasses. Possibilities of life and death moved darkly in them.
What now?
Piper said. Time to call Dad again.
27. It was not 6:21. It was either late at night or early in the morning. When Adam and Ronan arrived at the Mountain View Urgent Care, they found a small waiting room empty except for Gansey. Music strummed overhead. The fluorescent lights were soulless and innocent. His khakis were bloody,
and he sat in a chair with his head in his hands, either sleeping or grieving. A painting of Henrietta hung on the wall opposite him, and water dripped from it, because that was apparently the world they lived in now. Another time, Adam might have tried to understand what such a sign meant. Tonight, his mind was already overflowing with data points. His hand had stopped twitching now that Cabe's water had regained some of its strength, but Adam had no illusions that this meant the danger was over.
"Hey, shitlord," Ronan said to Gansey. "Are you weeping?" He kicked the side of Gansey's shoe. "Sphincter, you asleep?"
Gansey removed his face from his hands and looked up at Adam and Ronan. There was a small smear of blood by his jawline. His expression was sharper than Adam had expected and only grew sharper when he saw Ronan's filthy clothing.
"Where were you?"
"Cabe's water," Ronan said.
"Cabe's what? What is she doing here?"
Gansey had just caught sight of the orphan girl as she stumbled through the door behind Adam. She was clumsy in a pair of muck boots that Ronan had pulled from the trunk of the BMW. They were far too big for her legs, and of course entirely the wrong shape for her hooves, but that was kind of the desired effect. What was the point of us using an entire afternoon to take her out there if you were just going to bring her back out again?
"Whatever, man," Ronan said, an eyebrow raised at Gansey's fury. "It was 2 hours."
Gansey said, "Maybe 2 hours doesn't mean anything to you, but some of us go to school, and 2 hours is what we had for ourselves."
"Whatever, Dad."
"You know what?" Gansey said, standing. There was something unfamiliar in his tone, a bowstring drawn back. "If you call me that one more time."
"How's Blue?"
Adam interrupted. He already assumed that she was not dead, or Gansey would not have had the bandwidth to be arguing with Ronan. He assumed, actually, that it had looked worse than it had really been, or Gansey would have led with a status report. Gansey's expression was still edged and glistening.
"She'll keep the eye."
"Keep the eye," Adam echoed. "She's getting stitches now."
"Stitches," Ronan echoed.
Gansey said, "Did you think I was just panicking over nothing? I told you, Noah was possessed."
"Possessed? Like by a devil?" "Possessed, like Adam's hand."
In between that simmering black in Cabe's water and this violent result of Noah's possession, Adam was beginning to get a feel for what his own hand might be capable of if Cabe's water couldn't protect him. Part of him wanted to tell Gansey about it, but part of him had never forgotten Gansey's agonized shout when Adam had made the bargain with Cabe's water in the first place. He didn't really think Gansey would say, "I told you so," but Adam would know that he would have been within his rights to do so, which was worse. Adam had always been the most negative voice in his own head. Unbelievably, Ronan and Gansey were still fighting. Adam turned back in as Ronan said,
"Oh, come on. There was no way I cared if Henry Cheng asked me to a party."
"The point was that I asked you," Gansey said, "not that Henry asked. He didn't care. I cared."
"Aw," said Ronan, but not in a kind way.
"Ronan," Adam said. Gansey flicked at the bloodstain on his slacks. "And instead you went to Cabe's water. You could have died there, and I wouldn't have even known where you were because you couldn't be bothered to pick up the phone. Do you remember that tapestry that Mallory and I were talking about while he was here? The one with Blue's face on it? Oh, of course you do, Adam, because you dredged up those nightmare blues in Cabe's water. When the Noah thing was over, Blue looked just like it." He lifted his hands, palms out. "Her hands were all red. Her own blood. You were the one who told me, Ronan, that something was starting all those months ago. Now's not the time to be going rogue. Someone's going to get killed. No more playing around. There's no more time for anything but truth. We're supposed to be in this together, whatever this is." There was no effective protest to be made to any of this. It was all unquestionably true. Adam could have said that he had been to Cave's Water countless times to do the ley lines work and that he had thought this was just like any other time, but he knew full well that he had realized something was off about the forest and continued anyway. The orphan girl knocked over the coat hanger behind the office door and skittered away from the crash.
Quit screwing around, Ronan snapped. Counterintuitively, him losing his temper meant that the argument was over. Put your hands in your pockets. She hissed something back to him in a language that was neither English nor Latin. Here, in this mundane office, it was especially clear that she had been assembled according to rules from some other world. That old-fashioned sweater, those enormous black eyes, the slender legs with their hooves hidden in boots. It was impossible to believe that Ronan had pulled her from his dreams, but it had been impossible to believe his other outlandish dream objects, too. It seemed obvious now that they had been walking briskly for quite some time toward a world where a demon was plausible. They all looked up sharply as the door to the back opened. Blue and Mora stepped into the waiting room as a nurse began to shuffle behind the counter. All attention immediately shifted to Blue. She had two visible stitches in her right eyebrow, pinning together the cleaned-up edges of a gouge that continued down her cheek. Faint scratches on either side of the deepest wound told the story of fingers clawing into her skin. Her right eye was squinted mostly shut, but at least it was still there. Adam could tell that she was hurting. He knew he cared about her because his stomach was tingling uncomfortably just looking at her wound, the suggestion of violence scratching through him like fingers on a chalkboard. Noah had done that. Adam curled his own hand into a fist, remembering what it had felt like for it to move on its own accord. Gansey was right. Any of them could have died tonight. It was time to stop playing around. For a strange second, none of them spoke. Finally, Ronan said,
"Jesus God, Sergeant. Do you have stitches on your face? Bad ass. Put it here, you asshole."
With some relief, Blue lifted her fist and bumped it against his. "Corneal abrasion," Mora said. Her humorless, businesslike tone betrayed her concern more than any crying could have. "Antibiotic drops should be okay." She eyed the orphan girl. The orphan girl eyed her back. Like Ronan, her attentive stare landed somewhere between sullen and aggressive, but the effect was slightly more uncanny when presented by a waif of a girl in muck boots. Mora looked as if she was about to ask something, but instead she retreated to the counter to pay for the visit. "Look," Gansey said in a low voice, "I need to say something. This is a strange time to say it, but I kept waiting for the right moment to do it. And I can't stop thinking about how, if tonight had gone worse, I might have never got that moment. So here it is. I cannot ask you to be truthful if I haven't been myself." He gathered himself. Adam saw his gaze land on Blue. Judging, perhaps, whether or not she knew what he was about to say or whether he should say it. He touched his thumb to his lower lip, caught himself at it, lowered his hand. "Blue and I have been seeing each other," he said. "I don't want to hurt any feelings, but I want to keep seeing her. I don't want to hide it anymore. It's eating me. And nights like this, having to stand here and look at Blue with her face like this and pretend like..." He drew himself to a stop, a full stop, a silence so intense that no one tipped any other sound into it. Then he finished, repeating, "I cannot ask you to do things I haven't been doing myself. I'm sorry for being a hypocrite." Adam had never quite believed that Gansey would acknowledge the relationship in such a pointed way, and now that the confession hung in the air, it was intensely unpleasant. There was no joy to be gained by Gansey looking so miserable, and there was no satisfaction to be gained by Gansey and Blue essentially asking for permission to continue seeing each other. Adam wished that they had just told him the truth all along. Then it would have never come to this. Ronan raised an eyebrow. Blue drew her fingers into small, tight fists at her sides. Gansey added nothing else, simply waited for judgment, his uncertain gaze on Adam in particular. He was such a tattered version of the person Adam had first met, and Adam couldn't tell if Gansey was becoming someone different or if he was returning to someone he'd already been long before. Adam rummaged within himself for anything that he wanted Gansey to say now,
but nothing stood out. Respect was what he had wanted all this time, and respect was what he was looking at, even if it was belated.
"Thank you," Adam said, "for finally telling us."
He meant, for telling me. Gansey knew it. He gave an infinitesimal nod. Blue and Adam regarded each other. She sucked in her lip. He lifted a shoulder. They were both sorry.
"Good. I'm glad that's out," Gansey said in an airy voice. Long ago, Adam would have found this breezy response unbearable. He would have assumed it was flippancy. Now he knew that it was the opposite. When pressed too close to something huge and personal, Gansey ducked away into cheery politeness. He was so out of place here in this urgent care and this tumultuous night that it was truly unsettling, particularly paired with the continued disarray of his expression. Blue took Gansey's hand. Adam was glad she did.
"Gross," Ronan said, which was the most juvenile response possible. But Gansey said,
"Thanks for the input, Ronan,"
with a proper look on his face again, and Adam saw how cleverly Ronan had released the tension of the moment. They could all breathe again.
Mora returned to them from the counter. Adam got the distinct impression that she had been loitering there, intentionally giving them all room. Now she took out her car keys and said, "Let's get out of here. These places make me nervous."
Adam leaned to bump his knuckles against Gansey's. No more playing around. There was only time for truth.
28. Depending on where you began the story, it was about Declan Lynch. Although it was hard to believe, he hadn't been born paranoid. And really, was it paranoia when you weren't necessarily wrong? Caution. That was what it was called when people really were out to kill you. He'd learned caution, not paranoia. He'd been born pliant and trusting, but he'd learned. He'd learned to be suspicious of people who asked you where you lived. He'd learned to talk to his father only on disposable cell phones bought at gas stations. He'd learned not to trust anyone who told you that it wasn't honorable to long for a historical townhouse in a corrupt city, a master suite with a tiger skin rug, a case full of beautifully winking bourbons, and a German car that knew more about the world than you did. He'd learned that lies were only dangerous if you sometimes told the truth. The eldest and most natural son of Neil Lynch stood in his Alexandria, Virginia townhouse and leaned his forehead against the glass, staring out at the quiet morning street below. DC traffic was only beginning to growl to life, and this neighborhood had yet to shake itself to waking. He was holding a phone. It was ringing. It was clunkier than the work phone that he used for his internship with Mark Randall, political denizen and golf ball killer. He'd intentionally chosen a model with a decidedly different shape for his father's work. Didn't want to scrape his hand through his messenger bag and grab the wrong one. Didn't want to feel the nightstand in the middle of the night and speak easily to the wrong person. Didn't want to give the wrong phone to Ashley to hold for him. Anything he could do to remind himself to be paranoid, cautious, while running the Neil Lynch business was a help. This phone hadn't rung in weeks. He thought he'd finally gotten out of it. It rang. He debated for a long time if it was more dangerous to pick it up or to ignore it. He readjusted. He was no longer Declan Lynch, ingratiating political whippersnapper. He was Declan Lynch, Neil Lynch's steel-jawed son. It rang. He picked it up. Lynch.
"Consider this a courtesy call," said the person on the other end of the phone. Music was playing in the background, some wailing string instrument.
A thin, viscous string of nerves stretched and dribbled down Declan's neck. He said, "You can't possibly expect me to believe that's all this is."
"I would not expect any such thing," replied the voice on the other line. It was clipped, amused, accented, invariably accompanied by music of some kind. Declan knew her only as Sun Duck. She didn't buy many artifacts, but when she did, there was no drama. The understanding was clear. Declan presented a magical object. Sunduck made an offer. Declan handed it over to her, and they parted ways until next time. At no point did Declan feel he might be capriciously stuffed in the trunk of his father's car while listening to his father being roughed up or handcuffed and forced to watch his parents' barn get tossed in front of him, or beaten senseless and left half-dead in his Aglimby dorm room. Declan appreciated the little things, but none of them could be trusted. Caution, not paranoia.
The situation is very volatile back in Henrietta, Sunduck said. I have heard it is no longer Greenmantle's store.
Volatile. Yes, that was a word. Once upon a time, Neil Lynch had sold his artifacts to dealers all over the world. Somehow that had gotten narrowed down to Colin Greenmantle, L'Aumônier, and Sunduck. Declan assumed it was for security, but maybe he was giving his father too much credit. Maybe he'd just alienated everyone else.
What else have you heard? Declan asked, neither confirming nor denying.
I am glad to hear you do not trust me, Sunduck replied. Your father talked too much.
I don't appreciate the tone, Declan said. His father had talked too much, but that was for a Lynch to say, not some Korean dealer of illegal magical antiquities. The music in the background wailed an apology.
Yes, that was rude of me. The word is that someone may be selling something special in Henrietta, Sunduck said.
The nerves drooled down Declan's collar. Not me.
I did not think so. Like I said, courtesy call. I thought you might want to know if wolves were coming to your door.
How many wolves? The music tripped, restarted.
There may possibly be packs and packs.
Maybe they had found out about Ronan. Declan's fingers tightened on the phone. Do you know what they are howling for, Seong Sang Nim? Sunduck said. It was an evocative noise that conveyed both that she knew he was sucking up and that she accepted it nonetheless.
This secret is still very young. I called in hope that I could give you enough time to act.
And how do you think that I should act?
It is hardly my place to tell you. I am not your parent.
Declan said, you know I have no parents. The music whispered and sighed behind her. Finally, she repeated,
I am not your parent. I am just another wolf. Don't forget that.
He pushed off the window. I'm sorry. Now I was being rude. I appreciate the call. His mind was already digging through worst-case scenarios. He needed to get Ronan and Matthew out of Henrietta. That was all that mattered. Sunduck said,
I miss your father's finds. They are most beautiful. He was a very troubled man, but he had a most beautiful mind, I think.
She was imagining Neil Lynch going through closets and collections and basements, carefully curating the objects he found. Declan imagined something closer to the truth. His father dreaming at the barns, in hotel rooms, on couches, in the back seat of the BMW that was now Ronan's. Yeah, Declan said. Yeah, I think so too. 29. Sleep snatched, breakfast skipped, school attended. Gansey could not tell how close it had to be to the end of the world, his world, before he could justify taking school off to chase Glendower, and so he kept going. Adam went, because Adam would cling to his Ivy League dreams even if they were being borne skyward in Godzilla's jaws. And to Gansey's amazement, Ronan went as well, nearly making them both late as he scrounged for a complete uniform in the mess of his room. He suspected that Ronan was only attending to make up for the fight in the urgent care the night before, but Gansey didn't care. He just wanted Ronan to log some time in a classroom.
Henry caught up to Gansey in the hallway of Borden House as he left class, French, to replace his defunct Latin studies. Gansey preferred Latin, but he was not terrible at French, so n'y a pas de quoi fauter un chat. Henry skipped until he was in step with Gansey.
Hey, Junior, is everything joy in your world after last night?
2 steps down from joy. We had a very good time last night at Litchfield. It was rude of us to run out when we did.
We only watched music videos on our phones after you left. The mood sagged. I tucked in the children and read them stories, but they kept asking after you.
This made Gansey laugh. We were having adventures.
I thought so. That's what I told them.
Carefully, Gansey added, an old friend wasn't feeling well. It was not a lie, just not an entire truth. It was the edge of a truth.
Henry raised an eyebrow to demonstrate that he clearly spotted this edge, but he didn't tug at it.
They'll be all right?
Noah's face went to inky black. Noah's sister stood on the auditorium stage, bones yellowed beneath an Aglimby sweater. Gansey said,
we remain optimistic.
He did not think there was anything off about the tone of his voice when he said it, but Henry's gaze darted over to him quickly. That eyebrow quirked again.
Optimistic? Yes, you are an optimistic person, Gansey boy. Would you like to see something interesting before lunch?
A glance at his watch told Gansey that Adam at least would be looking for him at the dining hall soon.
Henry swiftly interpreted this look. It's right here, in Borden. It's cool. It's Gansey-like.
This struck Gansey as patently absurd. No one knew what Gansey-like was, even Gansey. Teachers and family friends were always collecting articles and stories that they thought might capture his attention, things they thought were Gansey-like. The well-meaning items always addressed the most obvious parts of him. Welsh kings or old Camaros or other young people who had traveled the world for bizarre reasons no one else understood. No one dug down past that, and he supposed he didn't much encourage it. There was a lot of night in those days behind him, and he preferred to turn his face into the sun. Gansey-like. What was Gansey-like?
Does that smile mean yes?
Yes, good. Follow me, Henry said. He immediately pitched left through a narrow door labeled Staff Use Only.
Borden House had originally been a house, not an academic building, and the door opened into a narrow staircase. 1 fussy sconce lit the way. The light was swallowed by hideously busy wallpaper. They started down the stairs.
This is a very old building, Dick III. 1751. Imagine the things it has seen. Or heard, since houses don't have eyes.
Currency Act, Gansey said.
What?
Was passed in 1751, Gansey said, banning the issue of currency by New England. And George III became Prince of Wales in 1751, if I remember right.
Also, Henry reached for a light switch. It barely illuminated a low-ceilinged basement with a dirt floor. A glorified crawl space, with nothing but a few cardboard boxes shoved against one of the foundation walls.
The first performing monkey act in the United States.
He had to duck his head to keep from tangling his hair in the exposed wooden beam supporting the floor above them. The air smelled like a concentrated version of Borden House's above ground floors, which was to say like mold and navy blue carpet, but with the additional damp, living scent peculiar to caves and very old basements.
Really, Gansey said. Maybe, Henry said. I tried to find primary sources, but you know the internet, man. Here we are.
They had come to the far corner of the basement, and the single light bulb by the base of the stairs did not quite illuminate what Henry was pointing at. It took Gansey a moment to realize what the blacker square in the already dark dirt floor was.
Is it a tunnel? He asked.
Nah.
A hidey hole? Gansey asked.
He crouched. It seemed like it. The hole was no more than 3 feet square with edges worn by the centuries. Gansey touched a groove in one edge. It had a door at one point, I guess. They called them priests' holes in the UK. Must have been for slaves or for alcohol during Prohibition, maybe?
Something like that. Interesting, yes?
Gansey said. It was historical. That was Gansey-like, he supposed. He was vaguely disappointed, which must have meant that he had hoped for something more, even if he didn't know what that something more would have been.
No, the Gansey-like part is inside, Henry said.
To his surprise, Henry slid into the pit, landing at the bottom with a dull thud.
Check it out.
I assume you have a plan for getting back out if I do.
There's handholds.
When Gansey did not move, Henry explained.
Also, this is a test.
Of what?
Merit.
No, ma. No. There's an M word for bravery, but I can't recall it. My frontal lobe is still drunk from last night.
Metal. Yes, yes, that's it. This is a test of metal. That's the Gansey-like part.
Gansey knew that Henry was right by the zing of feeling in his heart. It was very similar to the sensation he'd felt at the toga party. That feeling of being known, not in a superficial way, but in something deeper and truer.
He asked, "What is my prize if I pass?" "What is ever any prize of a test of metal?" "The prize is your honor, Mr. Gansey."
Doubly known. Triply known. Gansey wasn't precisely sure how to cope with being so accurately pegged by a person who was, after all, only a recent acquaintance. So there was nothing left but to lower himself into the hole. It was almost completely dark, and the walls intruded. He was close enough to Henry to both smell the bite of Henry's hair product and hear his slightly accelerated breathing.
"History, that complicated bitch," Henry said. "Are you claustrophobic?"
"No, I have other vices." If this had been Cave's water, it would have been rapidly working with Gansey's fear to produce stinging insects. Gansey was grateful that intention was not such a powerful thing outside of Cave's water. This hole in the ground could remain simply a hole in the ground. In this world, he only had to worry about schooling his exterior, not his interior. Can you imagine having to hide in one of these? Did I pass the test? Henry scratched at the wall or something similar. It made a dead hissing sound as dirt crumbled to the floor.
Have you ever been kidnapped, Richard Gansey?
No. Am I being kidnapped now?
Not on a school night.
I was kidnapped once, Henry said. His tone was so light and ordinary that Gansey wasn't certain if he was making a joke or not.
For ransom.
My parents were not in the same country, and so communication was not good. They put me in a hole like this. It was perhaps a bit smaller. He was not joking. Jesus, said Gansey. He could not see Henry's face in the darkness to know how he felt about the story he was telling. His voice was still light.
Jesus was not there, unfortunately, Henry said.
Or perhaps fortunately.
The hole was barely big enough for me.
Gansey could hear Henry rubbing his fingers against each other or making and unmaking fists. Every sound was amplified in this dusty chamber, and now he could smell that peculiar scent that came with fear, the body producing chemicals that reeked of anxiety. He could not tell, however, if it was his or Henry's, because Gansey's mind knew that this hole would not produce a sudden swarm of bees to kill him. But Gansey's heart remembered hanging in the cave in Cave's water and hearing the swarms develop beneath him.
This is Gansey-like too, yes? Henry asked. Which part? Secrets.
True enough, Gansey admitted, because admitting you had secrets was not the same as telling them.
What happened? What happened, he asks. My mother knew that to pay the ransom right away was only to encourage others to kidnap her children while she was not watching, and so she haggled with my captors. They did not like this, as you can imagine, and they had me tell her on the phone what they intended to do to me every day she did not pay.
They had you tell her?
Yes, yes. You see, that is part of the haggling. If the parent knows that the child is afraid, it will make them pay faster and more. That is the wisdom.
I had no idea.
Who does? Now you do.
The walls felt closer. Henry went on with a little laugh. A laugh.
She said, I do not pay for damaged goods. And they said that was all she would get, so on and so forth. But my mother is very good at bargains, and so after 5 days I was returned to her with all of my fingers and both of my eyes still. For a good price, they say. I was a little hoarse, but that was my own fault.
Gansey didn't know how he felt about this. He had been given this secret, but he didn't know why. He didn't know what Henry wanted from him. He had many assembled reactions prepared to deploy: sympathy, advice, concern, support, indignation, sorrow. But he didn't know which combination was called for. He was used to knowing. He didn't think Henry needed anything from him. This was a landscape with no map. Finally, he said, and now we're standing in a hole just like that, and you sound quite calm.
Yes, that's the point. I have spent many years in pursuit of being able to do this, Henry said.
He took a short, thin breath, and Gansey was certain that his face was telling a far different story than his still, airy voice.
Instead of hiding, facing the thing I was afraid of.
How many years?
How old were you?
10. Henry's sweater rustled. Gansey sensed him repositioning. His voice went a little different.
How old were you, whoop whoop Gansey boy, when you were stung by those bees?
Gansey knew the factual answer, but he wasn't sure if that was the answer Henry wanted. He still didn't know why this conversation was happening.
I was 10 as well. And how have those years treated you?
He hesitated. Some better than others. You saw, I suppose.
Do you trust me? Henry asked.
It was a loaded question here in the dark and the more dark, here in the test of metal. Did he? Gansey's trust had always been based in instinct, his subconscious rapidly assembling all markers into a picture that he understood without knowing why he understood it. Why was he in this hole? He already knew the answer to this question.
Yes. Give me your hand, Henry said.
With one of his hands, he found Gansey's palm in the darkness, and with the other, he placed an insect in it.